Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you to the second part of Theatre Voice's latest monthly critical roundup. We've already covered a series of revivals. Now I'm joined by regular panellists Charles Spencer, Matt Wolfe and David Benedict to discuss three new shows. The first two are both at the National Theatre. Verbatim documentary theatre, using the actual words of people involved in the events being dramatised, has become a regular occurrence lately, but the National have boldly done something brand new with London Road. They've turned the true story of a serial killer of prostitutes in Ipswich into a musical, setting the real words of those from the local community to new music by composer Adam Cork. Matt, have you seen any of Aleke Blythe's previous works?
No.
Where she uses this technique called recorded delivery, and they repeat exactly in sync with what's playing on a tape in their wearing headphones. Luckily, she's ditched the headphones on this occasion, I'm pleased to say. But I just loved this piece. I thought it was so clever and so moving.
Yeah, I have a very minority feeling about this piece. But first of all, I wasn't moved by it at all. But secondly, the ethos of it I found rather odd. And it was very interesting not going on a press night, because the night I was there, you could really tell that here is this middle-class National Theatre audience watching lots of middle-class actors playing this Ipswich community with sort of faux vocals, and it felt for a long time very peculiarly like a Mike Leigh play, and we weren't quite sure, are we laughing at them, are we laughing with them, and that really set me on edge almost right at the beginning. And the only moment of that really got me, and I'm probably the only person in London who thinks this, is towards the end they drop all that and you just get the actual voices of the people involved, and I thought, that's what I was missing, that's what I wanted to hear. I don't want all this artifice, just let me hear the people themselves saying these words.
But the question I have then is, you say not going on a press night, did you go in knowing something about it?
I knew a lot about it.
Yeah, the interesting thing is when you see it on a press night and you don't know much about it, it really surprised me, completely took me by surprise.
Yes, it did me. I've read a bit about some of the parents of the prostitutes taking offence at it and complaining about it. I didn't think it patronised its characters at all. I mean, they just had East Anglian accents, and I found it very, very moving. What was extraordinary is that these little phrases, often sort of almost sort of, just a couple of words would be repeated again and again. I thought the music was wonderful, that it turned it into something like that. And I thought it was also quite a tough piece. I mean, there's a bit at the end where one of the women said that the death of these prostitutes had actually helped the community, which is strong stuff to smuggle into a sort of a play that's meant, a piece that I think, you'd expect to finally end up on a note of hope. And also the appearance of the prostitutes themselves at the end. And Aleke Blythe is actually very sympathetic to prostitutes. She did a wonderful play about prostitutes in Bournemouth, where she lived in a brothel for 3 months with them.
The girlfriend experience,
which was an extraordinary piece. So I did like it very much. I can see Matt's point of view, but I think it's slightly unfair.
I also think it takes the musical in a new direction, which is, I mean, it's music theatre rather than a music hall, but given that the National, I mean, Nick Hayne launched the National with Jerry Springer the Opera when he took over, and he's done barely any new musicals since. He's done two imports from Broadway, and I thought at last we've got a different sort of show on at the National.
That's true. I mean, I will come back to that. I mean, all I would say about what's been said earlier is that clearly Matt and I were separated at birth. I had exactly the same reservations, exactly the same misgivings, and exactly the same points of reference, thinking I have the same nervousness that I feel about Mike Leigh. I mean, I think if they didn't speak in East Anglian accents, if this had happened, she did a show about events happening after a siege in Hackney, if they'd all been giving Hackney, Cockney accents, then that would have been different. But we sit there sort of feeling utterly superior because they talk regional accent. That's funny, isn't it? And I know that's not the intention, but that is how it comes across. I think that the cast are without flaw. I mean, I've sung a lot of weird things in my time, and I can think of no score that would be harder to learn. This is, I don't think we've made it sufficiently clear, this is taking verbatim recorded speech and setting the speech patterns. Now, this has been done before, unlike most of the national publicity about this. Janáček was doing this 75 years ago. But from na-na-na-na-na in a playground where you can notate that shape, Adam Cooke has notated the speech patterns. And that is, for the first 10 minutes, mind-blowingly amazing. I sat there in awe, both of the performance and of the musical technique. But the problem is that, Marx, you say that this takes it in a new direction. I don't think it takes it anywhere, I think, is the problem. I think, as a one-off, it's remarkable. But the more the piece develops musically, the more you get more than just the notated speech, and it turns more choral, the less it sounds like the original speech, at which point you go, well, this is sort of disobeying its own rules. Either it sticks to the rules of, we are going to set musically what was said, or you go, we're writing a choral fantasia. And the more the choral fantasia moves on, the more interesting it becomes musically. But it takes away from its initial impact.
Yes, what they're doing at the end, yes, as it goes on, they're just using a group of three words, aren't they, and repeating them in different. So it becomes more or less like a mass, doesn't it?
I mean, it's a sort of oratorio piece.
It's an oratorio, yes.
I thought musically it was a lot more interesting than it was textually. I think what it really doesn't have, frankly, is much of an element of surprise. It told me what I thought I was going to hear, and it said it again and again and again, using, garden centers and flowers and whatever is a very overworked metaphor. The only interesting bit is the bit Charlie referred to, which actually does catch you completely unawares, where Kate Fleetwood says, actually, this is a good thing that the prostitutes
are dead.
And then you think, now this is something complicated about human behavior. But the rest of it, I thought, in essence, was rather banal, I'm sorry to say.
Because it's taking it, actually, it isn't the story of a serial killer set to music. I can see why people would have got very, very upset if that were the case. We do not have singing murderers. This is simply the people that lived
except
on that road. And their responses, which is an interesting idea. But I also have to say that I have great problems with verbatim theatre because I think it's somewhat specious. And I think after a play like Dennis Kelly's Taking Care of Baby, which explodes the myths of verbatim theatre. You know, this is entirely Alecky Blythe. I know she's using real people, but everything is in the edit. We've known this since,
it's editorialised.
It's up to the choices that you make govern the piece. And as both my colleagues here are saying, the most interesting moment is when someone says something unexpected, and you go, if this piece had been full of observations like that, then it would have been textually interesting. But in fact, it's merely more of the same. It's also one of those shows, if it were 90 minutes straight through, I think a lot of my criticisms would have been made less, because you would have gone, okay, but actually you come back after the interval and you go, oh, there's just more, there isn't. And there's a big problem with a musical where the most exciting moment, the most tense moment, is when nobody says anything. There's a moment where the prostitutes don't speak, and you go, in a musical, that's the best bit. I think we have a problem.
On to One Man, Two Governors. Classic plays don't need to be stuck in the past. They can be vigorously re-examined or entirely overhauled while still maintaining a connection with the play's original impulses. That seems to be entirely the case with the National Theatre's One Man, Two Governors, a thorough makeover of Goldoni's classic 18th century Italian comedy The Servant of Two Masters, with the action relocated by playwright Richard Bean to early 60s Brighton. Charlie, we've spoken about comparing contrasts with Much Ado's, but Servant of Two Masters versus One Man, Two Governors. When did you last see Servant of Two Masters?
There was a production of the RSC did about 10 years ago with an actor whose name I now...
Jason Watkins,
who was good.
He was very good.
But I have to say, I thought that this takes it into another league. It's a knockout evening. I mean, it's one of the great comic nights, I think. I think it stands up in my memory to seeing Michael Frayn's Noises Off for the first time. It's not quite as perfect, but actually Michael Frayn's Noises Off actually subsides a bit in the last act. After the interval, there's nothing quite like the scene where he serves dinner to two different people with a waiter that doddery waiter who keeps being knocked down the stairs, which is just bliss. It's one of those nights where you go to the theatre and you are actually helpless with laughter. And a lot of that is due to, and it's actually a sort of tripartite success. It's not, it's Richard Bean has written a really good script. I mean, it's all very well saying, you know, it's the servant of two masters, but basically this is a new play with the same plot, and it's the 60s atmosphere is brilliantly evoked. What a brilliant idea of having the girl dressed as a boy looking just like Ringo and things like that. It's got so much going for it. Heitner directs, I think this is Heitner at his very, very best. I mean, Heitner is sort of like he's just been let off the leash and on holiday. And then James Corden, who a lot of us felt rather dubious about and seemed to be turning into a sort of monster prick of, constantly publicity seeking, is just gives this wonderful, warm-hearted, belching, funny, cordial performance. I just loved it. And it's going to be huge. I mean, it's just going to go on and on, this show. And it's payday for Richard Bean at last, actually, because he's actually had a real moneymaker. And he writes more than anyone else I can think of.
Indeed. I mean, it's already going on, first of all, a national tour, but then it is heading sort of straight to the West End as soon as they can sign the contract.
Yeah, I mean, this is a what's not to like? I mean, I completely agree with Charlie that I think this is a three-way thing. I mean, And when you walk into the theatre, there's a fake pros. The whole, I think Mark Thompson's design is masterly. You get this sort of rather sunny and yet faded fake pros, in front of which there's Grant Alding and three other people doing this 60s skiffle band. And they're doing these numbers. And they do numbers whilst we all take our seats. So everybody is warmed up. It was really noticeable in the first scene proper, it was getting a huge number of laughs. Now, the scene is funny, but it's not that funny, and that's because we're in such a good mood. We're just being set up so beautifully, and it is a masterly piece of direction. The Cal McChrystal is in there, who works with people like us and a lot of other physical theatre companies, and quite clearly he's done a lot of the physical comedy work. But just, it has a completeness of vision through Mark Thompson, through a crackerjack cast, through the direction. You just know that everybody understands what it is they're doing, and it's amazingly rigorous. And then at the heart of it, there's James Corden. You know, this is the building that made his name. This is the director that made James Corden's name. So, you know, he's not doing the James Corden show. He's doing an actor in this piece, and it is so beautifully placed, and the audience is having, and I suspect everybody in it, is having a ball.
And totally different, of course, from the show that James Corden there, The History Boys. I mean, it couldn't be more different.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting with this production because it's completely glorious, but, you know, you often see these lines in reviews and you think, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, or that's physically impossible, like I laughed until I cried. I think actually this is the first time in my life, in the first act, I did actually laugh until I cried. And I thought, oh, that is actually not just a sort of rhetorical posture. It's entirely possible. And what's great about it is it seems to take everyone to the absolute sort of top of the mountain. Richard Bean, who I like The Heretic very much. Some of his other stuff I haven't liked so much. He seems to write a hell of a lot, almost, you think, too much to really give anything real weight. But this is such an affectionate and joyous piece, shot through with love of theater. There's a character in it who's a very vainglorious actor, played by Daniel Rigby. But I want to give a particular shout out to somebody we haven't mentioned, Oliver Chris, who is just sublimely funny, using phrases like country life as a sort of expostulation, and he's so hilariously puffed up and full of himself. I could have watched him for days. And Tom Eden, who plays this 87-year-old waiter, who I'm told in real life is 34, it's one of the most sort of physically sensational transformations I've ever seen, because he looks hollowed out, sunken-cheeked, his eyes seem to be recessed way back into his face. It's extraordinary.
And the way he goes down those stairs, I mean, it's like a vertical drop. It's just unbelievable. I love the way they just keep doing it again and again and again, and it gets funnier each time.
You used the line "laughter, you cried." I felt I stopped breathing at that point. Yeah. I was talking to the producer of The Noises Off, the last producer of The Noises Off, who said that apparently at one performance somebody in the audience stood up and stopped
the act and said, stop, I can't bear it anymore. And that's what you wanted to say on the first night of this show.
Well, there's a bit where James Corden walks on stage with me, and there's a picture of the Queen, and he looks at her and says, who's that? And I knew from this moment it was going to be just great.
But also, right at the start, he does that wonderful trick of throwing a peanut up in the air, and it's going to catch in his mouth, that actually goes over the back of the sofa. He's a big chap, yeah. You know, and he's fantastically nimble, isn't he?
Yes. But his connection with the audience is incredibly infectious, and he just plays, as much as he plays with the other actors, he's absolutely playing to every member of that 800-900 seat house.
Finally, playwright Anya Rice wrote her first play, Sora the Moment, when she was just 17, and won both Critics Circle and Evening Standard Awards for Most Promising Playwright when it premiered at the Royal Court 2 years ago. Now she's back there with a new play, The Acid Test, and the question, of course, is, does it pass the acid test itself for living up to her early promise? David, starting with you.
Yes and no is the boringly fence-sitting answer about this. I really admired the first play. I still think that she is a writer. I don't think this is a terribly good play. It doesn't have a motor, is the problem. It has a lot of very nice observation, very nice characterization, and a good production from Simon Godwin. But I think that there is a problem. It sets up an expectation. It's a drunken night where there are revelations, but all the action happens off stage. And I know people will jump around and go, yes, but that's what happens in Greek tragedy. And you go, yeah. But this is a quiet play in which we are given to believe that the father, played by Dennis Lawson, of one of the girls sharing a flat, is going to cause some kind of trouble, and actually his presence doesn't really add or subtract anything other than some gags at his expense. People's sexual relationships are revealed, but none of it happens whilst we're watching it. It all happens off stage, so there's something missing at the centre to drive the play in a way that there were events, there was tension and resolution in Spur of the Moment, and there isn't here. That said, I think she is very skilled, and actually, thank God that there is someone like the Royal Court that will go, right, we're going to put on your second play, and we're going to do it now, rather than wait 2, 3, 4 years, where everybody's expectation is on the ceiling. She's got her second play out of the way, she can now write her third, and I look forward to it.
Yes, I mean, I agree almost entirely with that. You know, I was hoping that in the same theater a couple of years ago, Polly Stenham came up with a second play, Tusk Tusk, that in my view is actually superior to her first play. I think it's a great, great British play, and I don't know why it hasn't had a longer life. It's stunning. This is, in a way, it follows the same structure as her first one, Spur of the Moment, which was about the way in which a guy thrown into a household upends everything. But in that, it was a young guy who the much younger daughter of the household falls sort of dangerously in love with. This is the father of one of the people who is sharing this flat. And it's neither funny enough nor moving enough to merit all the stuff that happens through the course of the night. And actually, I found it rather exhausting. I just got exhausted by it.
And given that it's a one-act play,
it was a long one-act to me.
But it sets up the atmosphere beautifully. I mean, the moment you enter the theatre and you walk through the corridors, and it's done almost like a site-specific piece. And it's really clever.
The only thing I didn't quite get about it is these are meant to be quite well-heeled girls, aren't they? And it looks as though they're living in a really crummy council estate when you go in. So I didn't think that quite worked. This was very much the corridors we walked through as we went in was a rather awful council estate, whereas in fact they'd have been living in a...
Have you looked at London rents lately?
But you know what I mean. And so I was sort of slightly confused at first about exactly what social status these girls were, you know. The other thing I do think, I mean, there's no doubt it does not match up to the first one, which had this electrical charge, of course, of a possibly sexual relationship developed between an adult and a child. And this just doesn't have that motor.
Well, there was a hint of it, isn't there?
The father will seduce one of the...
Yes, but I don't think it's going to happen. It felt to me as though actually she might get a very nice sitcom out of this. It felt to me very like, you know, Three Girls. There used to be a show when I was a kid called Take Three Girls, I think, about a flat share. This looks like the one that could take over from it now. But as you said, and it's a second play. It's come on quickly. It's got it out of the way. And she can certainly write. And the dialogue sparkles and bubbles along. And Dennis Lawson is actually very entertaining as the father, who you're not quite sure how nice or nasty he is, and that suspense is well maintained.
But I do think there's a problem, you know, even with, you hear lots about the marriage that he's been turfed out of, but the whole play operates along the lines of reported speech. You don't get to engage with anything, you just keep being told about things.
And then there's a whole sort of score-settling side to it. So this will be the night at which the daughter lays waste against her father, a la Delicate Balance. But it doesn't really go anywhere.
It doesn't, no. It's a big anticlimax.
It is kind of interesting, though, the way in which Anya Rice seems to be playing with the notion, very self-consciously, of this is her second play. Not only does she call it the acid test, but there's a bit where somebody later on says, "What a drama!" And it's as if Anya Rice is very aware of the fact that she has to get through this.
The other thing is that we should point out how well acted Simon Goldwyn's production is. I think Phoebe Fox as Ruth is a real find. She's got amazing comic bones. You know, it's not a comedy performance particularly, but her timing is really, really fantastic. Very, very acute, but she can sort of mainline emotion very, very simply.
And can I just say, as the only straight man here, that actually those girls are all terribly fanciful.
I think we've all just been outed.
You've been outed on the internet, Charlie. But, come on, this is a historic day.
Thank you, David. Charlie, in that.